Strange it is that someone who specializes in other people's histories knows so very little about actual history. I look up at the house, nearly 2 centuries old. It's impressive. I definitely wouldn't be able to afford this in London, but then I'm not entirely sure I'd want to. I try not to think it, but standing there in front of it, it's hard not to feel that there's something slightly peculiar about it. Some strange quality. If I had to describe it, I would say it feels like the house is watching me. I know it's a ridiculous thing to say, obviously, I know that. In fact, I probably know that better than most people would because I know the exact neurological reasons my brain is thinking that. I know it's a trick of the mind. You know that feeling you get sometimes of being watched? Of somehow knowing before you know that someone is watching you. Well, it's a neurological phenomenon called blindsight. It's a completely normal feeling, a simple evolutionary process, perfectly explicable. Blindsight describes the process of seeing things that you weren't consciously aware you were even noticing. It's just the subconscious processing of visual stimuli. A lot of things we process day to day bypass our conscious minds. They get processed subconsciously, but to us, it seems as if we're just getting a funny feeling. I know the reason I feel like the house is watching me is because as I drove up to it steadily in the car, my subconscious brain was tricked into thinking the house was slowly looming towards me. My brain decided the house was getting closer to me rather than me getting closer to it. It's why tracking shots in horror movies work so well on audiences. I know it's the silence, the darkness of the woods, and the unusual surroundings that are all compounding, on a non-conscious level, to leave me with a feeling of unease. It's just my instincts doing their job. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But where would we be without them? I know why the hairs on the back of my arms are raised, but a part of me still can't help but wonder if the house in front of me is actually watching me. I find the key exactly where Peter's email tells me to look, under the leg of the bench by the door. I slide it into the lock, and the door creaks open in front of me. Inside is just as beautiful as outside. Deep plush sofas, Persian rugs, and polished wood. I could definitely get used to this. I wander from room to artfully curated room and wonder who on earth is funding all this. This is a nice house. This is an expensive house. But then I remember that the first choice for this assignment was Richard Groves. And Richard Groves doesn't exactly work pro bono. My employers were probably expecting to plough a fair amount into this anyway, and I'm definitely the cheaper option. Maybe me staying here has nothing to do with Peter Chorley protecting me. Maybe whoever organised the accommodation arrangements just couldn't be bothered to rebook. The house is fully stocked. There are flowers in vases in every room. In the white-tiled Victorian kitchen, the fridge is full of supplies. There's a printout from Peter on the kitchen counter, next to a neat stack of the patient's medical files and press cuttings. Whoever opened the house up earlier today and did all this must have dropped this off too. I read, "Dearest Emma, I hope the accommodation is acceptable and to your liking. I apologise for the remote location and distance from the hospital, but I'm sure you will appreciate the need. Thus far, the case has attracted quite a bit of media interest, and we found them to be both persistent and invasive. We have, however, supplied you with most basic amenities, food, household necessities, Wi-Fi, and some other bits and pieces to help you settle in. Let me know should you require anything else. I've instructed the hospital staff to supply copies of all medical files pertaining to the patient. I know you've been sent the scans already, but if you're anything like me, I'm sure you'd much rather have something solid to study at this stage. We've also left you cuttings of all the major news stories that have come out surrounding his story, as you expressed concerns around the effect they may have on the patient himself. And of course, as you mentioned, as hard as we all try, a hospital is not a closed system. There are a few eyewitness stories prior to admission that may be of interest, in terms of narrowing down the man's prior movements, but I'll leave all that to you. We can also arrange for you to meet with any of the patient's current carers, or anyone else close to the case you may think is helpful to speak to. As I stressed in our last phone call, budget is not an issue. Please do not see it as an impediment to expediting a diagnosis. And again, if you need any assistance from the local authorities in terms of relevant information, then please come through me and I can oil the cogs, as it were. The last thing we want is local red tape clogging up the process. And whilst, of course, this case is time-sensitive, with taxpayers' money, patients being a notably finite resource, we don't want you to feel rushed. Our primary concern is a solid diagnosis. There is no room for error here. Avoiding a situation in Norfolk similar to the publicity disaster in Kent is paramount. We have no desire for this to escalate. So, that being said, whatever you need, and whatever we can do to facilitate a quick, clear, and watertight diagnosis and corresponding treatment plan for this particular patient will be entirely at your disposal. You have my direct number. Feel free to contact me anytime, day or night. I'll be available. I'm your first port of call should you need outside assistance. Best of luck. Peter M. Chorley. Excellent. No pressure then. Chapter 11. The Man. Day 1. Chosen. Rhoda looks down at her patient on the trolley as they roll out into the ward. Right, you, she says with a smile. Apologies in advance for my driving skills. It's going to be touch and go for the paintwork, but you should be just fine. Hold on tight. A muted smile breaks across the man's face, and he gently closes his eyes. He's tired. He hadn't realized how tired until now. Around them, he hears the ebb and flow of the emergency department. He opens his eyes and catches brief glimpses of other people's lives as he's wheeled past cubicles. Half-glimpsed through curtains, he sees an elderly woman sobbing. He turns his head away. An Indian man is gasping into a handheld mask. Then it's on to a plump little girl laughing and bouncing on her father's bed as he lies watching her, smiling. The next curtain is closed, only a rasped groan emanating from within. He squeezes his eyes shut and pulls down his oxygen mask, breathing in his first breath of disinfected hospital air and its hint of something earthier at the edges. Rhoda glides them smoothly and skillfully down the corridor and into the lift. The white noise of the hospital is muffled as the doors close. Rhoda allows herself a quiet moment. She rests her eyes too, letting the events of the night and morning slide off her. When she opens her eyes, the man on the trolley is staring up at her, as beatific as a grazing cow. She smiles. You caught me. The lift pings, and its bulky doors open. The sounds of life flood back in. At the radiology nurse's station, Rhoda has a soft conversation with the ward sister. It's quieter up here, calmer. They look over at the man. The ward sister nods and calls over two healthcare assistants in forest green tunics. There's a brief exchange, then Rhoda wanders back to her patient. Right, handsome, she smiles. I'm going to have to leave you now with these two very charming gentlemen. She points to the care assistants with the green tunics. They're going to help get you all scanned and sorted out, okay? But it's not okay. The patient's eyes swivel to take in the carers. They look bored, tired, grey. They look like they don't care. The man's breath quickens. Panic rises. They do not look like Rhoda. They do not have the same look in their eyes. The man's hand shoots out and grasps Rhoda's wrist, not roughly, but firmly. Don't leave me, please. Rhoda jumps slightly, ever so slightly, at the suddenness of the motion, but manages to let out a quick laugh to cover her surprise. Oh, not a big fan of that idea, then. She chuckles and looks around at the care assistants. When she looks back, the patient is shaking his head forcibly against the pillow, wincing at the pain of it. No, no, stop that. Look, it's fine, she reassures him. These nice men are going to look after you just as well as me, I promise. Look at those lovely faces. How could you not trust those faces? The man blinks obediently at the two faces, placid and ghoulish in the hospital strip lighting. Rhoda leans in closer. I got to get gone. I shouldn't have come up here with you in the first place, but if I get back now, I can let everyone know where I am. I might even avoid a talking to. Would you let me do that? Would you help me out? He looks at her beseechingly. She loosens his hand from her wrist gently and he lets her. She places his hand deftly back down under the blankets, pats it once and smiles. Okay then, I'll see you later, she promises. As she turns to go, a lot of things happen at once. The man struggles to sit up, reaching out after Rhoda, but seeing the sudden movement, the assistants break into a sprint. They grab the man, pushing him roughly back down onto the trolley, restraining him. Rhoda turns back and a doctor rounds the corner just as the man's shouts begin. Rhoda stands there, frozen, helpless as her patient thrashes against the restraint of the two men. He arches his back away from the bed, part held, part scrambling to get away. The doctor joins the melee, carefully trying to disconnect the patient's IV, which is dangerously close to being ripped from his arm in the struggle. Nurse! He barks at Rhoda. Rhoda gasps and begins to step forward, then remembers her shift is over. Technically, she shouldn't even be here. She holds back a moment, watching the doctor's hopeless attempts to pacify her patient. Sir, he says, sir, I'm going to need you to calm down, please, sir. Rhoda takes a breath and makes a decision. She pushes her way to the trolley, leans over to look down at the struggling man's face, then carefully, she places both hands on either side of his head, a hand on each cheek. Seeing her, he stops struggling. Easy now, she croons. She slips his oxygen mask back over his mouth and nose. It's just the two of them. The rest of the scene disappears. The whoosh of air in his oxygen mask, his heartbeat thundering in his ears. The patient lets his body relax back into the thin mattress beneath him. He breathes. He looks up into Rhoda's warm brown eyes and blinks. Look, the doctor says, I know it's not your department and I know your shift's over, but this will all be so much easier with you here. It just will. I don't know how we're going to get him in the scanner otherwise. We'd need another two members of staff just to hold him down. If I ring down to triage and let them know what's happening, will you stay for the scan? Rhoda peers over the doctor's shoulder. The clock on the wall behind him reads 8:37. She's missed the triage handover anyway. And Annie will figure out what's happened if she's a couple of hours late to pick up Coco. It should be fine. Rhoda stays. The man lies quietly in the cream bulk of the CT scanner as it swirls around him. He breathes as Rhoda told him to. He tries to remain calm. He thinks of Rhoda's face looking down at him earlier. He knows she's not the one he's looking for, but she's all he has right now. He lies motionless as the machine accelerates around him, the sound of an aeroplane pounding down the runway seconds before catching the air and taking flight. A sound memory that seems to have no source as he interrogates it further. He squeezes his eyes shut tighter and tries not to think about everything else he can't remember. He tries to clear his mind. The man is retracted from the machine by a whir of mechanisms. Rhoda lifts his head from the plastic frame and gently removes his earplugs. With the help of a female radiology nurse, they transfer him back to the trolley. Behind the glass of the suite, the radiologist stares down at the images loading up onto his screen. The shadowy slopes and ridges of the patient's brain tissue maps out digitally before him. His eyes trip quickly, darting over the images as he looks for diffusion, patches of nebulous white, which could be signs of a stroke or a cranial bleed. Either would explain the patient's erratic behaviour after a head wound, No diffusion, no bleeds. But there, a tiny flare of white. Something, maybe. A neurologist is summoned. This man is older, his movements slower as he leans in and studies the scan. Ah, interesting, he says. But he doesn't sound interested. I think we should call Dr. Carver, actually, he says, removing his glasses. This is more his sort of thing. Carver will have a better idea. You'd better page him. He smiles a placatory smile and leaves. The man on the trolley is moved onto a temporary open ward with five other patients. Rhoda makes him as comfortable as she can. He looks across at her sitting next to his bed, the ward bustling around them. Patients in various stages of illness and recovery going about their bed-bound day. Rhoda gives her patient a quiet smile. He smiles back. And that is when the man three beds down starts to shout. And what happens next happens very quickly. Chapter 12. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 7. In the dark. The winter light starts to fade outside Cuckoo Lodge. I perch on the front garden bench, watching as the sun dips beneath the densely packed treetops. Smears of pink and peaches streak the sky, and the forest is full of evening birdsong. I check my watch. 4:30. Much earlier than I would have expected sunset to be. But then it's been a while since I've seen an actual sunset. At this time of day, I'm usually stuck deep within the bleached white bowels of an overlit hospital. I wrap the cashmere blanket I brought out tighter around me. A shiver runs through me, the cold from the flagstones underfoot seeping up through the wool of my fisherman's socks. I padded out early without putting my shoes on. I suppose I'd better go in. I gather my things and start to head in. I throw a glance out into the close-packed forest, the tangle of branches just visible between the trees, the murk beyond. A Rorschach test in the woods. It got dark so quickly. And nobody wants to be alone in the forest in the dark. That's for damn sure. Time to turn on some light. I lock the door and flit from one room to the next, flicking on lights, their warm glow creating company of sorts. Next, I set about getting a fire going. The log burner in the living room is beautifully stacked and ready to be lit, the handiwork of some poor assistant, no doubt, along with the fully stocked fridge. I needn't have worried about running short of supplies out here. I'm basically a bear ready to settle in for winter. And for some reason, I've also been supplied with my own brand new wellies. I found them box fresh waiting by the back door. God knows how they knew my size. Actually, now I come to think of it, they probably got that information from the hospital, which has my scrub sizes. Someone has really thought of everything. Peter and whoever. I suppose as far as Peter's concerned, the less reason I have to leave the house, the better. The fire crackles to life, leaping from paper to firelighter to kindling. I close the log burner door and let it roar to life, then go in search of Peter's welcome half bottle of wine in the kitchen. Just to warm me, just to settle those first night nerves and send me off to sleep at a sensible hour. Because, God knows, tomorrow is going to be one hell of a first day at work. I curl up on the Persian rug in front of the flames, glass in hand, and sip my wine. The patient's medical records spread out all around me. There's a lot to go through. Yet as I sit there, surrounded by the sea of papers, the case feels more manageable somehow, like a puzzle that I might actually be able to solve, piece by piece, a 1,000-piece jigsaw that just needs time and focus. My patient, a tangled knot to be gently loosened. Peter was right. I do prefer working with hard copies. I like to be able to see what I have. I pore over the test results again, eyes flicking from the patient's CT scans and the newer MRI scans on my laptop, to printouts of blood alcohol tests, virology, and hormone levels. A clearer medical picture is starting to form of my patient, just the edges at the moment, but the tests and scans he's already undergone show me the faintest outline of something already. Here's what I know. His brain is not physically damaged. That much is evident. The concussion he arrived with a week ago has left no lasting damage. There are other potential physiological causes that could be in some way responsible, which I can and will start testing for tomorrow. He may suffer from epilepsy or a nutritional deficiency. He may suffer from a non-related condition that requires medication, the side effects of which could somehow be responsible for his memory loss. Testing for outlying conditions would certainly be worthwhile. I jot down a quick list of possible tests in my notepad. Some screenings we'll have to send away for results. The Princess Margaret Hospital, where I'm heading tomorrow, isn't big. Its resources are acceptable, but they're nowhere near London standards. The tiny fleck I noticed when Peter first showed me the CT scan is clearer on these new MRI scans. Pituitary cysts aren't uncommon. Most people can live and die without ever even knowing that they have a cyst on their pituitary gland. These cysts only tend to get found accidentally, when doctors are scanning for other things, and are rarely a cause for concern. However, if this cyst has recently fluctuated in size and exerted pressure on a neighbouring area of brain, it could be in some way responsible. But it's unlikely. The area of the brain responsible for memory retrieval, the hippocampus, is nowhere near the pituitary, so I'm not sure exactly how the cyst could directly affect it. But it's certainly strange that other few cases have had similar growths. Something to look into further. I note it down. The spec is something to monitor, but at this stage I'm happy to put it on the reserve bench in terms of possible causes, and instead consider it a potential symptom or anomaly. If I'm totally honest, I'm already erring on the side of this not being a physiological condition. The scans show the patient's hardware is intact. If he were a computer and you took him to the Apple Genius Bar, they'd tell you it's a software problem. So assuming the patient's hardware isn't broken, then what we're looking at is a software problem. Psychological trauma. And mental trauma isn't that unusual a cause of memory loss. Post-traumatic stress disorder being the prime example, whether it's soldiers back from war or children in the care system, PTSD is a lot more common than people think. Up until fairly recently, in medical terms at least, the general wisdom was that psychosomatic illnesses were controlled by the sufferers. As if somehow the patient could just pull themselves together and then they'd miraculously recover and return to their normal lives. These days we know better. Psychosomatic illnesses are software errors, not user errors. If a patient's memory loss is due to psychological trauma, he would have about as much control over his illness as you would have over a system failure on your laptop. No matter how much you want those wiped family photos back, they are locked in that old hard drive, and you are going to need a lot of patience and a pretty pricey specialist to help you get them out of it. I take another sip of wine. The good news is that memory loss caused by psychological trauma is often only temporary. Memory tends to return over time once the real or perceived threat is removed. Patients slowly begin to regain memories. The trick is making sure the patient is in a safe and therapeutic environment when those memories, good and bad, do resurface, or the consequences can be troubling. A week ago, something very bad may have happened to this man. If he's been through intense trauma, then hopefully now he has some distance from it, we should be in a position to help him remember what happened, or at the very least, help him move on from it. I start to draw up my plan of action for tomorrow. I need to be prepared. This is important, for me and for him. We can't afford to mess this up, not with the whole country watching. My pen glides fast in wide loops and curls across my yellow legal pad as I pour out my ideas. The low lights in the living room flicker. I glance up at the lamp nearest me. It glows steadily now. But there was a flicker before. I'm sure of it. A break in the electric circuit. I stare at the bulb. It flickers again, like a moth against the glass. Then all the lights in the room and through the hallway flicker back in response. Oh no, 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 not the lights. And as if the thought were a wish, the whole house plunges into darkness. It's just the fuse box, I tell myself. Houses aren't haunted, people are. The edges of the room are no longer visible. Armchairs, bookcases and cushions have been swallowed up into the darkness. The kitchen is nothing more than a black void beyond the archway. Only the firelight remains, carving deep shadows into the space. My pulse is racing high and fast in my chest. Jesus, there's only darkness all around me. These things happen all the time in the countryside, I tell myself. These things happen all the time in remote cottages deep in the woods. It takes my eyes a fraction of a second to adjust to the light of the fire. I hear a noise outside, low and animalistic, a creature, a fox perhaps. I look to the patio doors, suddenly keenly aware of all the life outside this cottage. I realise that up until this moment, I've been lit up like a Christmas tree in here, exposed for all to see. But in the dark glass, I see only myself. My own ghostly face reflected back at me, flickering in the firelight. I quieten my breath and listen again for noises outside. I listen so hard the room buzzes with silence and the popping fire. It's just a power failure. Grow up, Em. I'd better find a flashlight in the fuse box and hope it's just that. If it's not, then it looks like I'll be heading to bed. I know from experience that you can't do anything useful after dark during a power cut. I find the flashlight under the sink in the kitchen and head for the basement. My mind creeps back to Holt again, to our old house. The staircase downstairs into the dark, the glow of a light from the study, the sound of dripping. I shake the memory away, shuddering. It's colder down in the basement, the air damper. Shadows leap and dance in the corners of my vision. I remember the thick pooling of dark arterial blood from long ago. A sound of breath rasping behind me. Stop it, Em, stop it. I throw the switch on the electric fuse box and the house leaps back to life. The darkness vanishes, and I'm standing in a basement laundry room. No spiderwebs and rot here. Just appliances and laundry detergent. I guess I overloaded the circuit turning on all those lights. Lesson learned. Chapter 13. The Man. Day 1. Mr. Garrett. Rhoda watches as the situation unfolds. There was nothing out of the ordinary about him at first, just another patient sleeping three beds down from Rhoda and her patient. He woke and shuffled awkwardly up into a sitting position, under the covers, his bleary eyes taking in the ward around him, perplexed. A young nurse further down the ward noticed him waking too, her eyes flicked out towards the corridor, apprehensive, before she made her way over to the waking man. Rhoda watches as the young nurse places a gentle hand on her patient. He frowns. Where is she? Rhoda hears him ask the nurse, his eyes scanning the beds around them. Where's Claire? She doesn't hear the young nurse's reply, but she recognises the expression on her face as she quietly speaks to the older man. Rhoda knows that bereavement notice needs to take place in a private consultation suite, with a doctor or a member of the bereavement care team. You can't give it on the ward. The young nurse will be asking her patient to wait for the doctor to arrive. I don't need a doctor. His voice is tight and hoarse, a trill of panic running through it. I just need to know where my daughter is. Rhoda remembers his details from the triage board last night. A car accident, a drink driving collision. The drunk driver had walked away with only bruises, but this man and his teenage daughter, who had swerved to avoid him, had sustained severe injuries. Rhoda's eyes float up to the name on the whiteboard above his bed. Mike Garrett. Although she can't hear the nurse's words, it's clear from her body language that the daughter didn't make it in the intensive care unit. Rhoda feels a deep ache in her chest. The worst news to give. The worst news to get. I don't need a doctor to tell me where she is. You can tell me, for God's sake. Just look on your system or something. You can tell me that, can't you? A few more eyes swivel onto the scene. I want to know where my daughter is. Do you understand? I don't care if the doctor's on his way. Hearing a raised voice, the duty nurse pops her head around the ward doorway and quickly makes sense of the scene. She makes the decision and calmly heads over to join the young nurse at the red-faced Mr. Garrett's bedside. Can I help, Mr. Garrett? She asks, her tone kind, delicate. Yes, I want to know where my daughter is. The duty nurse takes a breath and looks down. And when she looks up at him again, his breath catches in his throat. Finally, he sees in front of him what Rhoda sees. Two impotent nurses trying not to tell him that his daughter died from her injuries. Oh God. Oh God. He tries to choke back the sobs. Wild eyes, unseeing, she's gone, isn't she? My God. The duty nurse gives the younger nurse a look, and she starts to curtain off the bed. I'm sorry, Mr. Garrett, I'm so sorry. If you can just wait until the doctor gets here, we can... But Mr. Garrett is already pulling back his sheets. He staggers up out of bed onto unsteady feet. No, no, I want to know where the bastard is. Tell me where the guy is who did this to her. Where is he? Is he here? Mr. Garrett turns around, taking in all the patient-filled beds on the ward. You wouldn't be stupid enough to put him in here, would you? Everyone in the ward is watching now. Mr. Garrett, I'm going to ask you to return to your bed or I'll have to call security. The duty nurse throws a look to the young nurse behind her, who turns to leave. Don't you dare! If you do, God help me! A sharp burst of fear shoots through Rhoda. Her eyes widen, pupils dilate, her breath catches and holds, her posture stiffens. This is the thing that the quiet man lying next to her in his hospital bed notices. He turns his eyes away from the scene and back to her. But Rhoda does not notice. Rhoda is transfixed by the scene playing out as the hospital-gowned man strides further into the ward, towards their end, his wild eyes gliding over patients. Rhoda's gaze flicks back to the young nurse's face. She's biting her bottom lip, eyes furiously calculating her options. Rhoda can see it coming before the young nurse knows herself. She's going to make a break for it. She's going to run for security. Her body tenses. And then she bolts. She flies into the corridor, around the corner and out of sight. The man spins at the movement and yells out after her, but she's gone. Suddenly vulnerable and feeling the exposure of his situation, he looks around him for the closest thing he can use to protect himself when security arrives. He lunges towards the nearest patient's bedside cabinet and grabs a ribbon-festooned full bottle of whiskey. He grasps it, tight knuckles whitening as he raises it like a club, its warm caramel liquid gleaming as it sloshes inside. The duty nurse takes a step back. Please, try to stay calm, Mr. Garrett. If we could just... But Mr. Garrett turns from her, disinterested. He steps further into the ward, squinting intently to read the small whiteboards above the beds, looking for a specific name. Rhoda shifts forward ever so slightly in her chair. Somebody should call out, shout for help. Perhaps she should, but that could just escalate things. She darts a glance out into the hall for someone, anyone. She needs to act, she thinks. She takes a breath and starts to rise from her chair. But a movement comes from the bed next to her. Her patient is sitting up. He looks at her, not panicked, not concerned, and shakes his head. No, not you. She frowns. He's telling her not to intervene. Mr. Garrett has reached their end of the ward. He scans the names, the faces below them. Rhoda and her patient look to each other as his gaze falls on them, Rhoda's patient looks at her serenely in the eyes and she doesn't move. She heeds his advice, and Mr. Garrett turns away. He turns and starts to walk away. Suddenly, someone breaks through the small cloud of people by the door, a young male nurse making a run at the armed man. Other bystanders move back to clear his path. Mr. Garrett's eyes flare, and unthinkingly, he reaches out, snatching the nearest body, a man in his 70s, frail, wearing a Fair Isle sweater many sizes too large for him. The whiskey bottle crashes to the floor, shattering, splashing glass and richly scented alcohol across the ward. The old man drops his shiny new magazine with the shock of it, and it lands with a loud slap on the wet hospital linoleum. Mr. Garrett holds him roughly in front of him as a kind of shield, and the approaching male nurse stutters to a halt. "This isn't what I wanted, you know," Mr. Garrett tells the ward. He comes out shakily, off-key. I just want... Oh! He squeezes his eyes shut hard to think. "He killed my little girl. She was 15. He tells no one in particular. He's crying now, fat, wet streaks down his anguished face. The old man trapped in his arms scans the surrounding faces, searching for a clue to his fate, still held tight in the hold. "He killed her. And what? He gets to survive. No, he doesn't get to go home. I have to bury her. No, he doesn't get to survive and go home and live his life. You tell me where he is, or I'll find him myself. She was 15, for Christ's sake." The duty nurse looks across to the male nurse. She shakes her head. The male nurse swallows, straightening his shoulders before speaking carefully. He's new, young, and totally out of his depth. "It looks like the man you might be talking about has already been discharged, sir. Early this morning, so..." He doesn't know what else to say, but it doesn't matter. Mr. Garrett seems to crumple inside. He releases the old man, who falls forward onto the wet, glassy floor, shaking. Mr. Garrett sinks back onto the edge of an empty hospital bed as the male nurse cautiously bobs forward to help the terrified old man get up from the floor, pulling him back to safety. Mr. Garrett slowly reaches down to the floor and picks up a long, thin sliver of broken whiskey bottle glass. He studies its razor-sharp edges thoughtfully before raising it up to his throat. His face gleams with tears. A gasp from somewhere in the ward. Rhoda realizes she's holding her breath. Next to her, her patient pulls back his bedsheet. He's quietly removed his own IV and mask, and now he gently gets out of bed. Rhoda's gaze flashes swiftly to him, her eyes wild with concern. He gives her a soft smile. "I know what I'm doing." Mr. Garrett looks up at the movement. A patient, out of bed, making his way towards him, he presses the sliver more firmly against his throat, his quivering hand breaking the skin enough to release a thin line of red. But the patient keeps moving towards him, undeterred, his eyes locked on the quaking man, his gaze placid and steady. Confusion suddenly furrows Mr. Garrett's brow. "Was it you?" he splutters. "Did you do it?" He stands now, turning the glass blade on Rhoda's patient, but Rhoda's patient shakes his head. He's not the man Mike Garrett is looking for. Mike lowers the glass ever so slightly, perplexed by the advancing man. "This isn't what's supposed to happen," he thinks. "This man doesn't look scared. He looks kind." A sadness seems to burst over Mike, and he slowly sits back down. Rhoda's patient is inches away now. The room watches, mesmerized. There's an assurance to the way Rhoda's patient moves, a calmness. He seems to know what he's doing as he approaches the increasingly confused man. Close enough, Rhoda's patient stretches out a hand, palm up. Mike studies him, then lets out a deep, ragged breath, something inside him breaking under the strain. He begins to sob in wretched gasps. The patient takes another step towards him, then gently, almost tenderly, he takes the shard of glass from Mike's unresisting hand. He places it on the bedside cabinet and sits down next to him. The patient reaches out, and Mike lets himself be taken into a strong, masculine hug, his body loosening limply into that of his new friend. His eyes squeeze tight shut, and remembering all that he has lost, he lets himself fully surrender. After Mike has been led away to another room, Rhoda makes her way over to her patient. "That was very brave, but you should have let me help, you know. I could have helped." The patient shakes his head mildly. "No," his eyes say. He brings a hand up to her head now, by way of explanation, careful not to touch her skin and the angry comma of scar tissue near her hairline. "No, not you. Not again," his eyes seem to say. "Not this time." Rhoda's eyes widen and her breath catches. "He knows," she realizes. "He knows." What happened to her? How she got her scar? The scar that hasn't fully healed yet, inside and out. Her eyes fill. "He knows, and he was protecting me. He was protecting us all." She smiles up at him. He gives her a smile straight back. "Well," she says, "aren't you just a gift from God?" Chapter 14. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 8. First day. I grab the keys to the lodge, pull on my running shoes, and let the door bang shut behind me. I need to get my run in before work, as it'll be pitch black by the time I get back. It's drizzling slightly, which I actually like, the scent of rain fresh and pure in the early morning air. I decide to take a route out through the back gate of the garden that looks like it heads deeper into the woods. I want to see the forest in the daylight. I need to get used to it somehow, this dark tangle encircling me. I unhook the gate and set off at a brisk pace. The uneven ground is more interesting to negotiate than the well-kept footpaths of Regent's Park. It's only when my watch starts beeping that I become aware I'm soaked. My hands are numb, and my buzzing mind is finally clear. Time to turn and head back the way I came. Back at the lodge, I cook a quick breakfast and hop into the shower, letting the warmth seep back into my bones. I'm not entirely sure what the traffic is like between here and the hospital, so I decide it's best to set off early. They're expecting me at 9 a.m. Once I'm dressed and blow-dried and made up, I dash out through the rain again to the rental car, my new friend, my connection to the outside world. I think about turning on the radio, but decide that I don't want to break the soft bubble of silence surrounding me just yet. The comforting, aortic pump of the windscreen wipers is my only company for the rest of the drive. The quiet beauty of the countryside thins as I near the bland grey of King's Lynn. And finally, I see Princess Margaret's, rising like a concrete lighthouse from the drab sea of the suburban town. I feel my pulse quicken. The last time I was here, things were not good. I try not to think of that night. The coughing, the blood. But my cortisol spikes regardless. I park and look up at the hospital, blurring as rain splatters the windscreen. "I'm here for a reason," I tell myself. Somewhere inside is my patient, waiting, a knot to be loosened. Near the hospital entrance, the news vans are setting up for the day. Crews milling, bustling with umbrellas, coffee orders, production runners with anorak hoods up, darting between the gaps in a recently erected press cordon, huddled together, texting and laughing. "It won't be like last time," I tell myself. "They won't know who I am as I slip past them, at least not today. This afternoon they'll find out I'm the new doctor on the Mr. Nobody case, but nothing more. They won't know who I really am. That information would take a lot more than an internet search." But then I suppose time has a way of releasing the truth from its bedrock and floating it up into the sunlight. I might get mobbed with questions as I leave tonight, but it won't be like last time. And for now, I'm no one. I grab my bag filled with my notes and my laptop and dash from the dry heat of the car through the wet of the car park. I pull my coat collar up high over my head as I run, partly to protect my first day hair, partly as a barrier as I near the press area. But no one even glances up as I pass by. I'm early. The clock above the reception reads 8:39. I let my eyes drift over the lobby. The two security guards standing by the entrance of the main corridor to the wards. Are they there to stop the press getting in, I wonder? Or to stop someone getting out? Normal hospital life flows about me. Nurses arriving for shifts, visitors buying morning papers in the small shop. The layout is different to what I remember. It's been refurbished recently. A fledgling queue is forming already at the coffee concession opposite the reception desk, which I now make my way over to. I sign in with the elder of the two receptionists, and she peers down suspiciously at my name on her list. "Dr. Lewis," she says, looking back up at me frowning. "Oh, right. Well, that's a surprise. We assumed you'd be a man." She sounds annoyed. I attempt to smile, but she remains unimpressed. "It's the Lewis, I suppose," she posits. "Sounds masculine." I give her a supportive smile. I'm pretty sure it wasn't the Lewis that tipped the gender balance in her mind. But I'll give her the benefit of the doubt. It's the first day, isn't it? She holds a small camera aloft to take my picture, prints out the photo ID, then wordlessly assembles my day visitor lanyard and hands it to me. I stare down at it, unsure exactly what's supposed to happen next. The younger receptionist finishes giving directions to another visitor and smiles over at me. "Dr. Lewis, is it?" she asks. I give her a grateful nod. "Someone from HR will be up in a minute. You can have a wander if you like." She indicates the lobby newsagent and coffee bar. I thank her, but head over to the metal seating near the windows. More coffee would probably not be a great idea. I look down at my lanyard, a grainy digital image of me caught off guard. Below it, the name, Dr. Emma Lewis. That's me. That's who I am. Visitor ID lanyards aren't usually hospital practice, nor are the security guards on the ward entrance, at least not in any hospital I've ever worked in. But this situation is slightly different, I remind myself. This is a different political climate, and given the media outside and the government's interest in who this patient is or could be, a little added caution can only be a good thing, right? IDs stop outside threats. After all, I could be anyone, couldn't I? I could be a journalist. I could be a paparazzo. I could have a hidden camera embedded in my bag filming everything. I could be making a BBC Horizon documentary on poor healthcare. I bet those press photos spread across my bedroom floor back at Cuckoo Lodge made someone a hefty amount. There's definitely a market for information. People want to know. I feel eyes on me, but when I look up, everyone in the reception area is going about their own business. No one is looking. I let out a sigh. I need to relax. I'm not on display yet. Nothing has happened yet. I swivel in my seat and look out at the rain-soaked car park. Watching the weather is grounding, relaxing. There's neuroscience behind that, but I won't bore you with the details and take away the magic. I watch the rain collect and twist in rivulets as it glides and judders down the glass panels. I notice his hair first. Across the car park, a man stands talking to an older woman. I recognise that close crop of blonde curls. At least, I think I do. Neither has an umbrella. His back is to me, so I can't quite tell for sure yet. But I feel the queasy tingle of nerves in the pit of my stomach regardless. It's funny how just recognising someone in a crowd can cause such a strong physical reaction. He's tall, too, just like I remember. I brace myself for him to turn, to see me staring back at him through the smear of rain, for the spark of recognition to flare in his eyes. I steel myself for the inevitable look of disappointment on his face. The woman he's talking to gets into her car and he turns. It's not him. Relief flashes through me so powerful that I shudder. He's nothing like him, really. It was silly to think it was him. Good. The last thing I needed was a school reunion on my first day in a car park full of press. I count the press fans out there. 6, by the looks of it. BBC East Anglia, BBC News, ITV, Channel 4, and Sky. I wonder where all the print journalists are. I look back at the people in the lobby. The man in a barber is propped in the corner, his black scarf balled into a pillow as he naps. The teenager by the security guards, head bowed, is texting. The middle-aged woman in a beige-coloured suit is sipping coffee in the cafe as she jots notes in a pad. A gaunt, sharp-featured man is whispering to a smartly dressed redhead in the coffee queue. Her eyes catch mine for a microsecond and she looks away, absorbed in what the man is telling her. And suddenly I wonder if everyone here is press. Chapter 15. The Man. Day 1. Not a word. Paul and Graceford arrive at the hospital 19 minutes after the incident call goes out. They aren't the responding officers, that's the job of the King's Lynn station. Paul and Graceford are here because, in some capacity, their unidentified suspect from the beach was involved in this new incident. Their search on the beach was unsuccessful. No handy pile of clothes, no car keys or wallet, no shoes or coat. The identity of the man is still unknown. Trevor Kouassi, the Princess Margaret Hospital's head of security, makes his way over to meet them as soon as they enter. He's gone down to the King's Lynn station already, Trevor informs them, hitching up the waistband of his trousers, which is clearly in a losing battle with his comfortable girth. His name was Mike Garrett. Adams and Reese from King's Lynn just took him. You just missed them. He checks his watch to clarify. There's still a King's Lynn officer up on the ward, Mel Wheatley. She's taking witness statements. If you guys want to make your way up. Graceford gives him a nod. I asked all the witnesses to hang about in case you lot need to talk to them too. From the initial radio call, Graceford and Poole had assumed that the suspect was their unidentified man. But now they realise they were wrong. Leading them up to level 2, the security chief explains what he knows, which isn't much yet. Mike Garrett was looking for a discharged patient, a guy called Martins. Apparently Martins drove the car that hit Garrett's car, drink driving incident late last night. Garrett's daughter died. She died en route here. Martins came away with only bruises. He was discharged into police custody shortly after admission. To be fair to him, he was broken up about it, called 999 himself from the scene. Anyway, Mike Garrett couldn't handle the news. God knows what he would have actually done if he'd found Martins. And your guy, he somehow managed to sweet-talk Garrett into handing over his weapon. No struggle, nothing. How? What exactly did he say to him? Poole asks, frowning. I couldn't tell you, Trevor puffs, pausing on the half-flight landing to catch his breath. I've been hearing some pretty mixed things from witnesses. I think your best bet, witness-wise, is a nurse called Rhoda. I'll point her out to you once we're up there. She was with your guy when it happened. So if anyone should know... He shrugs and sets off again, leading them up. We'll need to talk to the patient, too. The man from the beach? Is he still on the ward or has he been moved? Graceford wants to know. Well, there's the thing. You can't really talk to him. Trevor gives a wry chuckle as he opens the level 2 doors. See, he's not saying anything. What do you mean he's not saying anything? Poole asks sharply. You mean he's still not talking? No, The officers from King's Lynn tried. The nurses tried. Nothing. Wait, Trevor, he's not talking about the incident, or he's not talking at all, Graceford persists, her brow furrowed. Like, he's mute. You've got to be kidding me, Trev. You don't seriously think he's mute. Or maybe he's not all there, Trevor says. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. Maybe he's done something and he's just keeping stum. How do I know? Or he's foreign. He might not even speak the language. Might not understand what we're saying. Immigrant or something. Okay, well, let's not jump to any conclusions. The last thing we want is an immigration officer down here. We all know how much everyone loves those. Graceford looks back to Paul. Where's the nearest detention centre, Chris? Could he have come from there? There's Yarlswood Immigration Removal Centre in Bedford, or maybe Fulton Hall Removal Centre in Lincoln. But that's too far. You think it's likely he's illegal? Graceford shrugs. I hope not, for everyone's sake. And I don't know why he'd be on a beach up here, unless there's some new North Sea crossing we don't know about yet. I suppose he could have just paid for passage on a fishing boat. The Norwegians get pretty close to the coast here. Surely we'd have found a life vest or something on the beach. There's no way he could have made it here without one. Graceford nods in agreement. Neither of them are convinced. Besides, the man they found didn't look like a refugee. At least, not like their ideas of one. But why would he be silent? Perhaps he has a reason to stay quiet. A nurse looks up as they enter the ward, scanning their uniforms and expressions with weary eyes. She rises to greet them with a tentative smile. How can I be of help, officers? Rhoda leads them to one of the ward's single occupancy rooms, where the patient is lying in bed, his head turned away towards the window. Hello, stranger, Rhoda says, tapping at the open door. The patient pulls his gaze away from the overcast sky and seems unfazed as the two uniformed officers fill the small room. I've brought some nice people to talk to you. Rhoda's tone is soothing. Nothing too stressful, I promise. This is Beth, she says, indicating Officer Graceford. And Chris. They'd like to ask you a few questions. They're the police officers who found you this morning. You feeling up to that now? The man in the bed regards them placidly. He gives Rhoda the smallest of nods, then shifts himself carefully up onto his elbows, resting back against the pillows. The officers pull up chairs and take a seat. When Graceford speaks, her tone is kind. How are you feeling now? You're looking better. It's true, he's almost unrecognisable from earlier that morning. There's colour in his cheeks, an air of self-possession about him. Graceford wonders if they've given him something, a sedative perhaps. She'll need to ask about that later. The man gives a restrained smile in answer, eyes shifting back to Rhoda. Graceford throws a quick glance to Paul. They mentioned to us you weren't speaking, she says. Is there any particular reason for that, sir? Can you understand what I'm saying? The patient's brows knit slightly, but otherwise his expression remains serene. He stays silent. Paul looks to Graceford. Either this man genuinely doesn't understand what she's saying, or he's a bloody good actor, she thinks. Paul and Graceford get lied to every day, and people aren't usually this good at it. Do you understand any of what I'm saying to you, sir? Graceford asks, louder now. The man looks back to Rhoda again, who nods him on encouragingly. He holds her gaze and he shakes his head slowly. He doesn't want to do this anymore. Paul tries now. Sir, can you tell us what your name is? The man moves his head to look at Paul. Paul points a finger at his own chest. Officer Paul, he says in a laboured and heavily accented voice. Graceford has to look down into her lap to stop herself from exploding with laughter. Paul is now pointing towards the patient, who watches him with intelligent eyes. You? Paul asks. The patient nods. He understands. He's being asked his name. He looks away from the police and the nurse and out at the murky sky. When he turns back, he shakes his head. But this shake is different. He can't answer their question because he doesn't know the answer. Chapter 16. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 8. Teamwork. When I enter the empty conference room, Nick Dunning, the chief executive of the Princess Margaret Hospital, and until recently its former chief of delivery and strategic management, is dumping packets of sugar into a steaming coffee, spilling most of it on the table as, distracted, he taps away at his phone. According to Peter, it's Nick I'll be liaising with at the hospital, but at the moment he's mid-email, head bobbed down over his phone. He looks up briefly as I round the conference table and take a seat, and flashes me a friendly, harassed smile before plunging back into whatever crisis is playing out in the palm of his hand. I pull my laptop and notes from my bag and busy myself with them, fishing out my proposed action plan of tests and diagnostic methods. I study his face as he scrolls. He's a lot younger than I thought he'd be, dressed casually, a brushed cotton collar peeking out under a chic grey sweater, stubble, fashionable horn-rimmed glasses that perfectly match the golden brown of his eyes. He's very attractive. After a long moment, he looks up again. "Sorry, Emma, Nick." He stretches his arm across the table and shakes mine warmly. "Rushed off my feet. It's been a bit nutty around here the last couple of days." He tips his phone by way of explanation. "I've been putting out a lot of fires, as you can imagine." "I can," I smile back blithely. Rushed off his feet is an understatement if ever I heard one. The amount of patient complaints and follow-ups over what happened on the ward last week alone would be work enough, never mind having to feel the level of intense public interest in one particular patient. "It's no problem at all. Take all the time you need, Nick, if you want to finish up." But he puts his phone away briskly and picks up his coffee cup. I put my notes down and give him all my attention. "Right," he says. "Right," I say. We share a moment. "God," he adds. "Yep," I say with a little nod. "Can I just say straight up front," I gush, "that the last thing I want is for you to feel like you're crisis managing this alone, Nick, or that I am in any way here to take over. I want to work with you. I need to. I don't know the hospital, and I don't know the case yet. I'm just hoping that we can get the situation sorted out together, quickly, as a team." "Yes, exactly." He tastes a gulp of coffee and grimaces. "That's exactly what we want here too. I can't say how relieved I was when they sent over your details. I like the tone of that misdiagnosis paper. The previous cases you re-examined, it's reassuring." He flashes a relieved smile. He's definitely not what I was expecting. And I bet I'm not what he was expecting either. I suppose I was expecting the CEO of an NHS Foundation hospital to be, well, older, a bit soft around the middle, a middle-aged man in a cheap suit. Not my age and, well, attractive. But I suppose the next generation of healthcare needs the next generation of management. He taps a pen gently on the table in front of him. "Are there any questions you've got straight off the bat, Emma?" "Well, I've looked through the notes, and at this stage it's looking like a psychiatric condition. I'm thinking post-psychological trauma, but I'm going to need more information, which means more tests. An EEG to check for seizure disorders. I need to be sure we haven't missed anything physically that could be causing this. But I think our key tool is going to be an fMRI. I need to do that as soon as I can." His brow furrows slightly. Like most NHS Trust CEOs, he has no specialist medical training. The job of hospital administrator is a non-medical posting. He'll have sat in on meetings about the patient for sure, and he'll have a degree of knowledge, but it will only be lay knowledge. I explain. The fMRI will tell me if the patient is lying, faking his symptoms. As I'm sure you know, Fugue has a bit of a history of that. He could be malingering for some reason, or he could be Munchausen's, meaning that he's doing all this for attention. Don't get me wrong, it doesn't sound like it, but the only real way to be sure is to do an fMRI. That should tell us whether the hippocampus is being activated to access memory. You can't fake memory loss in a scan. And what about this mysterious speck on his CT scans, the pituitary? Oh, the cyst, yes. Probably not related at all, but I will be looking into it, 100%. You can take my word for that. His face relaxes slightly. Great. Can I ask what's been happening regarding the patient's lack of communication? I ask. Sure, he dives in, eager to update me. Oh, we've been trying to organise a multilingual translator to come in. As you know, the media have been chomping at the bit with this whole foreign national thing, so I've been apprehensive about arranging anything that might confirm or strengthen those rumours without you having met him first. I'd rather hear your thoughts. I don't want to add petrol to the flames here, obviously. My breath snags. Petrol to the flames? What does he mean by that? It's a saying, Em, relax, it's just a saying, I tell myself. Nick catches my discomfort but misconstrues it. Of course, I can arrange the translator straight away if you need me to. No, I think you're exactly right. No need for that just yet. His silence could be a number of things at this stage. Something may be affecting the language processing area of his brain. I'll need to run some tests, or he may not be talking because he's scared. Any form of memory loss can be deeply disorientating. I'd like to do an initial assessment this morning, Nick, if that's possible. And has he communicated in any other way with anyone here at the hospital? Made any connections with other patients or staff? Yes, I think so. Well, I'd love to pull anyone else he's communicated with in for a quick chat, if that's possible. It'd be useful to know in what ways and to what degree he's been making himself understood over the last, 8 days? Yes, of course, I can find out who he's been communicating with. We'll make sure you get the opportunity to speak to those people, no problem. The idea suddenly occurs to me. Of course, there's always the possibility that the patient is deaf or has a pre-existing speech problem. Do you know if anyone's attempted to communicate with him via sign language? Nick squeezes his eyes shut tightly for a second. Shit. I'm guessing that's a no. He rubs his hand across his forehead. No, not to my knowledge, no. Don't worry, that's why I'm here, I reassure him. It's just another avenue we'll cover. There's also the possibility that he might have sustained damage to his vocal cords if he did almost drown the morning he was found. Either way, best to cover our bases on those points before moving on to any question of language. Yes, that's for damn sure. He wets his lips now before continuing. Can we just talk about the press? I know it's not your remit, but there are lots of crazy ideas floating around out there. Do any of them sound, I don't know, do any of them sound like possibilities to you? Having dredged through hours of media coverage online the night I agreed to take the case, and again last night in bed, I'm aware of what those floating ideas are. Well, the idea that he may be military and have returned from deployment in Syria is theoretically a possibility. Dissociative amnesia is a form of PTSD. He could have had trouble reacclimatizing to civilian life. It's a possibility. The refugee idea is equally plausible. Refugees are just as likely as soldiers to suffer from PTSD, as they're in the same war zones. Failed suicide? Yes, possible. A fisherman falling off a fishing boat? Sure, it's a possibility. But as far as I'm aware, there's no evidence of that. No one missing. The second coming of Jesus, / he's an angel? Medically speaking, it's not my remit. Nick lets out a loud laugh and I smile. Oh, and in terms of the Russian idea along the lines of the nerve agent released in Salisbury, chemicals are definitely worth testing for, although to my knowledge, he's not showing any related symptoms. I pause for a moment to see if there's anything I've missed. I mean, it's very strange, given the amount of press coverage, that nobody has come forward in 8 days to identify him. That should be telling us something, although I'm just not sure exactly what it's telling us. Yes, quite. Have the police made any progress? In a word, no. They've been keeping us in the loop, but they haven't been able to trace his journey before the beach. No abandoned cars found in the area. They've checked the CCTV in King's Lynn train station and local shops, but he hasn't shown up on anything yet. Plus, there was no ID on him, as you know, and his fingerprints aren't on the national database, so no luck there. Have the police run DNA? Nick raises his eyebrows. No, I don't think they have yet, he says hopefully. Definitely worth asking them for an update, as of today. He taps a note into his phone briskly, then looks at me with a smile of gratitude. Can I just say, Emma, I've never been so glad to have the troops called in on me. Something tells me before long we'll have something solid to show for our efforts. He rises, signalling that our meeting is officially over. Right, I hope you don't mind me springing this on you, but I've asked all non-essential staff to gather in the canteen. I thought you could do a quick intro and get your face out there so they all know who you are. How does that sound? Not good, Nick. Not good. Chapter 17. The Man. Day 2. How could he know a thing like that? Rhoda arrives for her shift 45 minutes early, her rucksack heavy on her back. After what happened yesterday, they've asked her to stay on the patient's ward again. They told her that she'd be staying with him for at least today, considering what he'd been through on the ward and given his unusual situation. If Rhoda were a cynical person, she'd say the hospital might be trying to cover their backsides over what happened there yesterday. How had that situation been able to occur on an active ward? Why had a confused and recently bereaved man been placed on an open ward and left unattended? It was a valid question that a lot of people were already asking. There had been reporters hanging around the hospital entrance last night after her shift ended. A woman and a man. They asked her what she thought about hospital security, what she thought about immigration, what she thought about the patient found on the beach that morning. Did she think he was a hero? They asked. Did she know his name? She hadn't wanted her picture taken, though they'd asked politely if she would. But it had been a long day, and she was worried it wouldn't come out well. Finally, she told them that she needed to go, and she'd thought no more about it. Since the scuffle on the ward, she'd replayed the incident with Mr. Garrett over and over in her mind. Should she have done something? What if her patient hadn't stepped in? What if it hadn't gone the way it did? If something very bad had happened? People could have been hurt because of her failure to act. She tried to remember her counsellor's words while she made a cold plate supper for herself the night before, her cream cockapoo cocoa bouncing around her heels. Her counsellor has been telling her for the past 5 weeks, since the incident in the park, that it wasn't Rhoda's fault. But it's hard not to blame yourself when something bad happens to you, because she knows if she'd just fought back, then maybe things would have been different. But the fact is, in actuality, she did nothing, and she let something terrible happen to her. She knows she can't blame herself. She shouldn't blame herself. But she does. Her thoughts had circled back around to her new patient, the odd feeling she'd had that he'd known about what had happened to her. It was the way he'd looked at her, the way he'd pointed out the scar running jagged down her temple, her dark skin puckered and still tender where the stitches had been. She'd been styling her hair differently to cover it. People at work had only noticed her new hairstyle, but Rhoda noticed the scar every time she looked in the mirror. And somehow, he'd noticed it too. How had he known? She hadn't told anybody what happened to her in the park. She'd only called the police, grudgingly, after realising that she wouldn't want the same thing to happen to someone else next time. Someone younger, or older. Someone frailer. She'd reported it, but she hadn't told anyone else, not her friends and certainly not her family. She didn't want them to see her that way, to think of her like that. She'd lied in those days after it happened and told anyone who asked that she'd slipped on the stairs in her building, rainwater on the steps, and people had grimaced and sympathised, but thought no more about it. The police had filed a report, but they told her that they couldn't do any more without eyewitnesses. And there had been no one else there that day, just her and Coco, and the skinny old man with his walking cane sitting on the park bench. She'd noticed his dog, a staffy, nosing around the bin for scraps off the leash. It had all happened so quickly. Usually Rhoda would unleash Coco as soon as they got to the park, letting her run free in her dizzying circles as happy as can be. But that day, seeing the staffy there, running loose, she kept Coco close. Her intuition had been right, because as soon as the staffy had looked up from its search and seen Coco, the dog had bolted full pelt straight for her. Rhoda had fleetingly thought to pick Coco up, but she hadn't had time, and it hadn't mattered anyway, because just before making contact with Coco, the big dog had swerved and knocked Rhoda down onto the muddy grass. A flash of pain had ripped up her leg and into her hip. A shout came from across the park, the old man's voice calling angrily to his dog, making his way to help her as fast as his cane would allow. At least that's what she'd thought, but as he got closer and she'd raised a hand so he could help her up to her feet, that's when the first blow came. His thick wooden cane struck her so hard across the cheek, the blow knocked the air straight out of her. She'd gasped a breath in to shout out, but the next blow came down before she could make a sound, and all the while he was shouting at her. Poor Coco was dancing around on the grass, yapping furiously. None of it made any sense as he glared down at her while swinging his cane a third and final time, his hate-filled voice saying terrible things, a storm of ugly words she would only begin to process afterwards. He told her she was stupid. A stupid bitch. Why had she got in the way? She was a stupid fucking N-word,